Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Saying it will take time and patience, President Bush delivered a speech this morning designed to shore up flagging public support for the war in Iraq. Bush spoke before a hand-picked audience at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. In front of a banner that read, Plan for Victory, he responded again to his critics and refused to set a timetable to bring American troops home from Iraq.
As the Iraqi forces gain experience and the political process advances, we will be able to decrease our troop levels in Iraq without losing our capability to defeat the terrorists. These decisions about troop levels will be driven by the conditions on the ground in Iraq and the good judgment of our commanders, not by artificial timetables set by politicians in Washington.
Well, first today, a debrief of the speech with John Harwood, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And John, 62% of Americans in an AP Ipsos poll taken in November say they disapprove of President Bush's Iraq policy. Do you think he said anything today that will get those people to change their minds?
Not really. It's very difficult for a president this far into a war, this far into a presidency, to change people's minds with words alone, especially on something that's gotten so much exposure as the Iraq War. But what he's trying to do is lay out a framework within which people can receive news about events on the ground and think about it somewhat differently. The American people every night on their news see more stories about suicide bombings, about kidnappings in recent days, and the president's trying to say, yes, but what you don't see is the progress we're making training Iraqi troops and rebuilding the country, and that is the context in which we may begin to be able to withdraw some troops next year, which is a goal that increasingly the American political process is focused on.
Well, the president also did not use the term insurgent. He gave an in-depth breakdown of what he called the resistance, calling the resistors rejectionists, Saddamists, terrorists. We know that Donald Rumsfeld has called for a ban on the word insurgents. We'll have more on that in a moment. But in the Democratic response, Senator John Kerry apparently didn't get the memo. He used the word insurgent many times. Is this definition important?
I'm not sure it matters all that much. You know, at the beginning of the conflict, Don Rumsfeld said that it was just a few dead-enders, and I've been looking over some previous presidential speeches, and the president said initially after the close of the war that there were a few Iraqi troops who'd fled the battle, Saddam's troops who'd fled the battle and combined with some foreign terrorists. But everybody knows there are plenty of people with the capacity to inflict casualties on both Iraqi security forces that we're trying to train and American military forces. And the issue is not what we call them, but what our strategy is for stopping them.
Yeah. Well, and the president also said U.S. troop levels would be set by commanders in the field, not by politicians. And he would send more troops to Iraq if necessary. But is this true? It seems to be contrary to statements that the Pentagon is actually going to start a drawdown of troops and other statements that there aren't enough troops to send more.
Well, they have increased troop levels temporarily in order to help secure the country in advance of the December elections. But it is increasingly an assumption by members of both parties in Congress, by people in the administration, that our troop levels are going to get smaller in 2006, perhaps under 100,000 from the baseline presence of 130,000 that we have now. What the president's trying to do in speeches like this and others to follow in the next few weeks is to tell the American people that when you see this happening, it's because our policy is working, not because it's failing.
Well, John Harwood, it seems as if the biggest mission of the speech was to have the word plan in a banner hanging on the wall. I mean, the word plan seemed to be key. The White House also has written up a 35-page plan that's on a White House website. We'll link you to it from our website. But was that part of the mission today?
No doubt about it. This was much less about news in terms of American policy or strategy in Iraq than about winning the public relations war. The president put out this extended strategy filled with buzzwords, things like clear, hold, build, engage and build in terms of the political infrastructure and the economy. This is a piece of argumentation. It's not a set of new developments in the war, and that was part of the Democratic response, was same old rehash, no news here.
John Harwood, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. John, thanks.
My pleasure.
And now we want to find out how President Bush's message resonated outside of Washington. We're joined by three journalists from different parts of the country. Howard Wilkinson, a political reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Howard, hello.
Good morning.
Bob Kittle, editorial page editor for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Robin.
And Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, as always, Pat.
Thanks.
And we want to start with Howard in Cincinnati, a Republican stronghold. President Bush, in fact, traveled to Cincinnati the day after he delivered his speech to the U.N. making the case for war. You went back and talked to some of the people who were in that audience that day. All of them had been strong supporters of the president and the war. What are they thinking now?
Well, certainly the attitudes have shifted over the last 3 years. I mean, this was an audience of people who were campaign contributors or people active in the Republican Party. It was a solid crowd, and they wanted a friendly audience for the president to deliver his speech to. Many of these people I've talked to over the last couple of months are just increasingly frustrated and looking for some kind of exit plan.
Yeah, well, Bob Kittle in San Diego, a red city in a blue state, and home to the Marine Base Camp Pendleton.
Right.
Your paper has editorialized consistently in favor of the war, but you have called on the president to lay out a plan. Did he do that today?
Well, I think he did what he had to do in this speech, which was to begin to shift the national debate away from the question of whether there should be a rapid pullout, which was the focus in recent weeks, to a debate about how to complete this mission. And I think he very clearly needed to show the American people that there is a way to win this war, that it is not a hopeless situation. You don't do that in one speech, of course, but I think he began with a lot of nuts and bolts to try to get Americans to focus on what the American approach here is, which, of course, is to train enough Iraqis to gradually take over the security operation and allow for a gradual withdrawal of U.S. troops.
There was an exhaustive, in fact, explanation of how Iraqi troops would be trained, but I'm wondering, I'm going to stay with you for a second, Bob, because this comes as we have an AP report today, two top Army analysts, Andrew Terrell and Conrad Crane, saying that it's no longer clear that the U.S. will be able to train an Iraqi military that can secure the country. New York Times writer Dexter Filkin says there's no good people left. They're either killed or they've left the country. So how is that resonating, do you think, that idea that Iraqi troops will be trained?
Well, at least in San Diego, there is a lot of support for the war because, as you said, this is a strong military community that has sent literally tens of thousands of men and women to the battlefield. But I think if, to the extent that the debate focuses on the workability of the strategy, its weaknesses and its strengths, the president has succeeded at least in the sort of the basic goal of getting Americans to focus on what needs to be done. I think there's going to be a lot of legitimate debate about whether it is possible to train enough Iraqis to allow a drawdown of American forces next year. That will play out on the ground. The president, of course, is going to present the most optimistic scenario, as he did today. That's his job. I think that's also an essential part of trying to sustain the strategy, is to try to persuade Americans that this can succeed. And in fact, I think, as so many others have said, wars are often not won on the battlefield, but on the home front.
Well, you know, I want to move to Pat Walker for just a second. She's in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, listening in. And her, Pat, your region, fairly moderate, mixed politically. It's gone Democratic in the last few presidential elections, but generally sends moderate Republicans to Congress. Do you think that your readers heard things they needed to hear today?
I hope so. I think the voices on our editorial pages have continually shown strong support for the troops, but there seems to be a growing discomfort with the war, with the mission, with the length, with the lack of an exit strategy and a clear plan. I think he highlighted a few things today that might give them some comfort. At the same time, I don't think he was pretty strong and committed about staying there until victory, and I'm not sure folks in this region would support that.
Well, and, you know, Howard, back in Cincinnati, I want to pick you up on something else. The president also had this exhaustive explanation of who the insurgents were. He never described them that way. Do you think that cleared up anything or is making things a little more confusing?
I don't know. I think most people in this area and most people I've talked to look at these people as Iraqis who are not happy about having their country occupied by a foreign military.
And enough said. They don't need to. They don't need to have distinctions made.
No, I don't think. I don't think that's going to be very helpful to the president's case at all. Particularly most people. I mean, what they really want, I think, is to be able to see an end. You know, and if that means a specific date, then so be it. But I don't believe that they heard that today.
Well, no, the president, in fact, said again, we will stay as long as necessary to complete the mission, sort of echoing his statement from a year ago.
Part of the problem is you've had, particularly in this area, you've got a lot of military families, too, particularly reservists and National Guard people and parents who sent kids to Iraq two and three times now. And I think there's just, even if they still support the president and the idea of Iraq, there's just a weariness.
Yeah. Well, and as you all have said, what has happened is that a national dialogue about a plan for exiting has started. And some would say that it's a Democrat who helped launch it, Congressman Murtha, who Pat Walker's from your area in Pennsylvania. Do you think, give me a read on that. I mean, does this administration now run the risk of having it appear that it's being pushed by voices from outside the administration?
I think that Representative Murtha just presented such an emotional and strong case that he sort of echoed and validated some emotions that folks are having throughout the country and certainly in this region, that it's okay to question, and if you question doesn't necessarily mean you don't support. I think it's a good, strong voice from the other side, and I think it's a challenge for the president.
Yeah, and Bob Kittle, again, in San Diego, home of Camp Pendleton, you speak with a lot of military families. What is your sense there of how they will respond to things that they heard today? Details, for instance, about training Iraqi forces to practice with AK-47s and to spend less time in the classroom, really minute details. Do you think this is something that's going to be appreciated by your community?
Well, I think the military families, as much as anyone else, want to see an end to the conflict, but an end on the terms that the president has outlined. So to the extent they see some progress, and quite understandably, we focus in the news media on the problems. We don't focus as much on the successes and the progress that has been made. To the extent that the president has focused a little bit of attention on the progress, I think that is encouraging and that's helpful.
But it sounds as if what all of your readers want is an exit strategy, a way to end it. Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier in Pennsylvania. You just heard from Bob Kittle, editorial page editor for the San Diego Union-Tribune, and Howard Wilkinson, a political reporter with the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thank you all for speaking to us today.
Thanks, Robin.
Speaking about President Bush's speech this morning at the Naval Academy. Well, coming up, how does a general disagree with the Secretary of Defense? The answer is politely, and it happened when the topic of how U.S. troops should report or stop abuse of prisoners came up at a press conference. We'll hear how that settled when we come back. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. And now, in his speech this morning, President Bush seemed to choose sides in the debate over terminology that was ignited in Washington yesterday. The president used words like sodomists and rejectionists to describe enemy fighters in Iraq, but never the word insurgent. Well, apparently that's a word Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wants to ban. Rumsfeld said at a Pentagon press conference yesterday that he now prefers to use the phrase enemies of the legitimate Iraqi government, a phrase which tripped up Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Peter Pace, who was standing next to Rumsfeld at the podium. And that was not the only awkward exchange between the two men. In an extraordinary moment, General Pace corrected Donald Rumsfeld on another topic, what U.S. troops should do if they witness abuse or torture. Here's Secretary Rumsfeld, followed by General Pace.
I don't think you mean they have an obligation to physically stop it. It's to report it.
If they are physically present when inhumane treatment is taking place, or they have an obligation to try to stop it.
Well, joining us on the line now, Pam Hess. She's the Pentagon correspondent for UPI and is just back from Iraq. And Pam, it was your question about torture by Iraqi authorities that sparked General Pace to contradict Donald Rumsfeld. It seemed to us an extraordinary moment. What do you make of it?
Oh, it absolutely was. I wasn't expecting there to be a division in that. When I was over in Iraq, I heard numerous cases of U.S. forces coming across prisoners that were being held in secret jails or Iraqi interrogators who were abusing prisoners, burning them with cigarettes or beating them up, and American forces have had to step in and stop it. And so I was just curious, given what I know about this Pentagon's view of sort of the legalistic aspects of Iraq, what Rumsfeld's perspective was on this. And what I mean by legalistic, I mean they put an awful lot of weight in the fact that Iraq is a sovereign country. It is certainly respectful to say that Iraq is sovereign and they make their own decisions and their own choices, but at the same time, the U.S. is there and has some level of responsibility for what goes on. And so I was interested to see how they were going to be splitting that hair, and apparently it was quite a large split.
Well, yeah, and it would seem as if the Secretary of Defense would know what the legal thinking was about something like reporting or stopping torture.
Yeah. It goes beyond legal thinking, though. This really has to do with military culture and the vows that the oath that the military takes, which is to protect the innocent. The UCMJ holds them to the military code of justice holds them to this, and it's something that they take with them all around the world. And it's been one of the undercurrents of this whole debate about torture and what it is that the civilians in leadership are doing to that military culture of protecting the innocent.
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld had another, what some of us thought was an eyebrow-raising response when he was asked about uniformed death squads in Iraq, which may or may not be made up of Shiite Iraqi policemen who are targeting Sunnis. Mm-hmm. He said he didn't know about them. And he also said the Defense Department had just begun oversight of the Iraqi police.
Right. DOD just took over oversight of the Ministry of the Interior. It's had an oversight over the Ministry of Defense since the end of the war, but the Ministry of Interior is new. They took it over 6 months ago. They're still getting their arms around it. It was a very typical Rumsfeldian response, and one that I expected, which is if he doesn't have to deal with something concrete, he doesn't. And in this case, some of these incidents are still being investigated, so he can take a pass on them. But the fact is that there are militias that are within, particularly within the Ministry of the Interior. The question that I think he was, again, splitting the hairs about is it officially sanctioned by the Ministry of the Interior, or is this just some sort of corruption going on at a local level? My feeling is it might be a little bit of a mix of both.
Well, you were just in Iraq for the third time. You spent 2 months traveling in 13 Iraqi provinces. Can you first just fact-check for us what President Bush said today and what Secretary Rumsfeld said yesterday about the readiness of Iraqi forces? Some 120 battalions have been formed. How ready are they?
It's a really hard thing to say because there isn't an objective measure. The objective measures that you can come up with are how many have been trained, how many are equipped, how many have actually been in the fight. But the rest of it is all art. It's all subjective. I was just emailing an officer today who's responsible for training special police in Bakuba, and we had that very exchange, which is you sort of know it when you see it if they're ready. I got an email this morning from a major in Baghdad who said he's been going into the fight with Iraqis to his right and to his left, and he feels as though they've got his back, so he's comfortable with it. Mm. The fact is that they really are all over the board. It's very localized. It depends a great deal on the quality of the Iraqis that they have leading each unit. If you have a good Iraqi in charge of it, and by good I don't mean it's not a normative statement about them as a person, but are they organized? Can they command leadership? Do they have a way of motivating the people that are fighting for them? Do they demand and get loyalty from them? Then you have units that are actually going in and doing really good work. But in places where there's a constant turnover at the top, the units just sort of fall apart and don't show up for work. And there's a lot of stuff that happens sort of culturally that our forces are sort of figuring out are not necessarily problems. One of them is that Iraqis frequently go what we would call AWOL. They disappear for a week at a time.
Well, Pam Hess, given that and given the size of the insurgency, again, you were just there. What do you think is a possibility for the future of the region?
It really depends on a lot of moving parts, many of which we don't have much control over, which is sort of the scary thing.
Well, in the minute we have, you have said that you think there could be the possibility of an Afghanistan-like ending. Explain.
That's the real fear over there. If the United States pulls out before the Iraq government has established its legitimacy, won the support of the people, and has gained positive control over every inch of that Iraqi territory, what could happen there, and this isn't alarmist, and it's already kind of in place right now, but what could happen there are groups like Zarqawis can take some of that territory and use it the way that Afghanistan was used, which is a place to rest, reset, raise funds, and have their headquarters. The really scary option in Iraq is if Baghdad, at the end of all of this, if Baghdad is tired of the fighting, tired of the car bombs, and they strike some sort of deal, tacitly or otherwise, with Zarqawi or his ilk to say, hey, you guys can have Western Anbar province, we won't bug you, just quit having car bombs in Baghdad. Then you have Zarqawi establishing himself the way that Osama bin Laden had his organization in Afghanistan. It's a very, very scary prospect.
And a Taliban-like organization welcomed in to restore order. A possibility, a darker scenario from Pam Hess, a UPI correspondent who just returned from Iraq, dark compared to President Bush's more optimistic speech delivered this morning. And we'll keep an eye on both outlooks. Pam Hess, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now.
Here and Now. In 1954, the Atomic Energy Commission held hearings on scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer, who'd been accused of being a security risk. The panel eventually revoked Oppenheimer's security clearance, effectively removing him from the debate over nuclear weapons, and according to a new book, removing him as a break against the nuclear arms race. Author Priscilla McMillan joins us now. Her new book is called The Ruin of J. Robert Oppenheimer and the Birth of the Modern Arms Race. There are many players in it, but today we'd like to distill it down to the rivalry between Oppenheimer, who headed the Los Alamos atomic bomb project, and Edward Teller, who worked on the atomic bomb but eventually got his own lab at Livermore and pursued the more powerful hydrogen bomb. And Priscilla, much has been written about Oppenheimer on this year's 50th anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Japan. But who was Edward Teller?
Edward Teller had come to the United States from Hungary in the mid-1930s. He taught at George Washington University. He was very anti-Soviet because Hungary had been taken over by communists when he was a young man, when he was a student. And he was a brilliant and imaginative and really very gifted physicist.
Where did he and Oppenheimer begin to have this disagreement?
Teller wrote that he first had some second thoughts about Oppenheimer when they were traveling on a train in 1942, and Oppenheimer told him that after the war, they would have to combat military influence in the program that they were about to start work on, the atomic program. And he said that made him suspicious of Oppenheimer very early.
Because Teller later befriended the military and politicians. And also later, Oppenheimer becomes increasingly alarmed at the effects of the bombs. Oppenheimer wants the public to know more about them. Teller wants more secrecy. And there's another incident in the book where you write that Oppenheimer tried to be a break on Teller's fears about the Soviet Union.
Very shortly after the Russians had tested their first atomic bomb and our aircraft picked up fallout, Teller called Oppenheimer and said, "What should we do about it?" And Oppenheimer said, "Keep your shirt on."
Well, here's where the rift deepens even more, and Teller begins moving away from the scientific community and towards politicians who agree with him about the Soviets. But to Oppenheimer, you write, he had his own flaws. He could be cruel. But he also was open to attacks that he might be a security risk.
Oppenheimer had been quite far to the left during the 1930s. He'd been a professor of physics, theoretical physics at Berkeley. He had been, as he later said himself, a fellow traveler. But he denied that he'd ever joined the Communist Party. And the evidence seems to me to be that he did not, that he was telling the truth when he said he did not join the party. But there always hung over him that question mark because his brother, his fiancé in the 1930s, his sister-in-law, and his wife had all been Communist Party members, and so had some of his physics students at Berkeley.
Well, it's hard to imagine today, but this international superstar is called before hearings in 1954. Many scientists, including Albert Einstein, call the charges of being a security risk outrageous, but Teller testifies against Oppenheimer. Priscilla, you write that the hearings marked the end of Oppenheimer's influence over the arms race, that he possibly could have slowed it. We want to hear more about that. But also that the hearings marked the end of the direct dialogue between presidents and scientists that Oppenheimer once had, and that they were devastating for him personally.
Oppenheimer was really, in some ways, destroyed by having his loyalty questioned. He had done the most, perhaps, of any other single individual to win the war for the United States, or rather at least to end it. And he had, after the war, continued as the U.S. government's most important advisor on nuclear energy and foreign policy. So to have him accused of being a security risk went to the heart of U.S. foreign policy, but it struck Oppenheimer at the heart as well.
We're speaking with author Priscilla McMillan. You say your book is a description of the people and events that led to the destruction of Robert Oppenheimer, but that there are stories like it today as well. What did you mean by that?
At the present time, there's great distress in the scientific community about the fact that the Bush administration is ignoring scientific evidence, which to them, many of them, appears conclusive about climate change and other subjects, even evolution, creationism. Scientists are working on government programs, but they feel very much abused, and they, I think, have lost respect for the president's chief scientific advisor, who is one of them.
And J. Robert Oppenheimer, as we said, such a last tragic chapter. How might American history have been rewritten had things turned out differently?
Had Oppenheimer been left to live out his career without the shadow of suspicion falling over him, he would have been consulted by the Kennedy administration. As it was, the Kennedy administration tried to rehabilitate him, but it never used him as a scientific advisor. He would have been used certainly by Kennedy and probably by Johnson, by President Johnson, but his voice would have been louder, and the voices of other scientists who agreed with him, and that was most of the physics community, would have been louder than they were and would have had more weight with the government.
Priscilla McMillan, her book is The Ruin of J. Robert Oppenheimer and the Birth of the Modern Arms Race. Priscilla is associate of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Thanks so much for coming to talk with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note about a story we've been following. Today, Supreme Court justices have been firing questions at New Hampshire's Attorney General Kelly Ayotte, asking about the state's parental notification law for abortions. The case before the court tests whether a state can require that doctors cannot perform an abortion on a girl younger than 18 unless a parent has been notified, even in instances in which the girl faces a health emergency. The law's only exemption is if the girl faces imminent death. Ayotte is arguing that the law should be upheld. Opponents say the law does not protect the health of the mother and will erode a woman's constitutional right to have an abortion. This is the first abortion case for the new Chief Justice, Judge John Roberts, rather. It's also the first abortion case the court has heard in 5 years. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. The United Kingdom is buzzing over a new gadget that claims to have the power to send unruly teenagers scurrying. It's called the Mosquito, and it's being marketed to shopkeepers who are fed up with loitering kids. The device supposedly emits an annoying sound at a frequency only young people can hear. Well, joining us on the line is the Mosquito's inventor, Howard Stapleton. Welcome, Howard.
Hello.
Also joining us is Rob Goff. He's owner of Spar Convenience Store. It's on the coastal town of Barry in South Wales, and it's the first store to use the Mosquito. Welcome to you, Rob, as well. And does it work?
Yes, it has worked. In the 6-7 weeks we've had this installed, our problem of youths and gangs hanging around outside the shop has completely stopped.
Well, this is amazing. And Howard, I know when you were 12, you heard a tone that no adult could hear, and that made an impression on you. When did you decide to turn that childhood experience into this new device?
It was a local shop of mine at the beginning of the summer holidays from school. They were having a serious problem, so it flagged back up in my memory, and I decided to give it a go.
And you came up with the Mosquito. Okay, we have to hear this, or try to hear it. Howard, could you go ahead and play the tone for us?
Yes, certainly. Here we go. I'll give you a 5-second burst.
Okay. I heard nothing.
And there we go.
I heard nothing. I heard nothing. I'm
no.
Agent.
Oh, I'm sure you're not.
Well, could you just play it again, just for 5 seconds?
Yes, certainly. And there we are again.
Nope, nothing. Rob, how old are you?
I'm 34.
Oh, gosh. Can you hear it?
I couldn't hear that over the phone then, but I can vaguely hear it outside my shop.
What does it sound like?
To me, it sounds like a very high-pitched, almost like a bird chirping.
Can either of you mimic it?
Oh, I don't know. Beep, 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 beep. It sounds like a demented alarm clock.
Yes. Well, while I didn't hear it, I felt sort of a pressure on my ears. I don't know if that's a part of it.
People do report that, yes.
Yeah. Well, Rob Goff, who again has this Mosquito at his store, what have you told teenagers about, you know, why you're using it?
Well, initially I told them it was to keep the birds away from the front of the shop because we had lots of hype at the time with bird flu and the possibility of it infecting our country. Obviously, my cover's been blown now because I've been in every national paper, TV, radios. So now they're fully aware of what it is. But I don't see the youths that were giving me problems. I just don't see them anymore. So, you know, I was expecting them kind of to come back and maybe cause some trouble, you know, when they found out what it was, but I just haven't seen them.
But Howard, why do only teenagers hear this sound?
That's quite interesting. What you don't notice is as you get older, your hearing deteriorates.
What? Little joke there. Go ahead.
And by the time you reach your 30s, you've lost a few kilohertz of your higher tone hearing, and this is what the system relies on.
Isn't that something? Well, other businesses, as you know, have tried to deal with this problem of loitering kids by playing classical music. We understand that something called the Zit lamp has also been used. It's a blue light that makes embarrassing, you know, pimples more visible. Terrible. And why do you think this is a better alternative, Rob? Because, you know, in fact, you know, people in their 30s, as you point out, can hear it as well. I mean, aren't you afraid of scaring away customers?
No, because, I mean, although I can hear it, it's not annoying to me. And likewise for the teenage customers that can hear it quite clearly, and if they stand around, it will be a problem to them. If they're just walking in through the doors of the shop, you know, for just legitimate reasons, it's not going to cause them a problem, because it's only when you stand there and the noise goes on and on and on, and the longer you stand there, the worse it gets for you.
And Howard, we understand you're also thinking of developing a louder unit that can be used to deal with a phenomenon known as steaming in the UK. Can you just tell us briefly, what is steaming?
Yes, what happens there is you end up with large gangs of kids coming into the shop, so many of them so quickly that they overwhelm the staff in the shop, and there's wholesale theft. But as I said, it would be very difficult to steal something if you've got your fingers in your ears. I've actually just adjusted the unit so everyone will be able to hear it if you'd like a listen.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Here we go.
I can't hear.
There we go. I suspect you heard that. Okay.
I couldn't hear that. No.
I didn't hear anything.
Oh, let's one more try. Okay. One more try. Was that any better?
My gosh, Howard. No. I'm going to go have my ears checked as soon as we leave here. Howard Stapleton, the inventor of the Mosquito, a device that breaks up groups of loitering kids by emitting a high-pitched sound only they can hear. And Rob Goff, owner of Spar Convenience Store in South Wales, he says it works. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Here and Now. Murder Ball, one of the most acclaimed documentary films of the year, follows quadriplegic athletes as they prepare for the 2004 Paralympic Games.
What we do is we take these wheelchairs and make them into a gladiator, a battling machine, a Mad Max wheelchair that can withstand knocking the living daylights out of each other.
The majority of the people that play wheelchair rugby have broken their necks. So we have rods, plates, screws inside. The biggest misconception is, you're quadriplegic? Oh, I thought they couldn't move their arms. And I'm like, no, I have impairment in all four limbs.
That's Mark Zupan, one of the stars of Murder Ball, which has just been released on DVD. We spoke with Mark and the film's co-director, Dana Adam Shapiro, when the film first came out.
Everybody get back! Get the hell back!
Okay, so I watched this gripping film, which had my heart going from the first second. I was trying to think, how would I describe this? And I was coming up with phrases like punk quadriplegics, quadriplegics with attitude. How would you describe the guys that you played rugby with?
Pretty much normal, but twisted in a way. I mean, we're normal guys, but we like to watch Jackass. We like
the TV show.
Yeah. We like good music, good food. We like to dress pretty hip. And a wheelchair is not going to change you. It's just going to expand your horizon and show you that there's that much more to do and that much more fun to have. Your life isn't over because you're in a wheelchair. And being exposed to wheelchair rugby has been godsend. I've been exposed to different people, different lifestyles, different challenges, avenues, places to go. I mean,
yeah. Well, but Dan, as I said, there's an attitude in this film. It is starkly different. I mean, what Mark just said so eloquently, we've heard that before, but there's something in this film that we haven't heard or seen before. What do you think it is?
I think a lot of times movies about the unfortunate, be they cripples or any type of, you know, quote-unquote victim, tends to be a little bit heavy on the sentiment, a lot of cueing of the violins and pulling the heartstrings, and that attitude, that sort of good for you, it's so good to see you out.
Woe is me.
That type of stuff. Well, it seems, and I know it does come from a good place, tends to be a little condescending in its treatment of the guys. I mean, we treated them just like regular people. The chair was definitely a huge part of their identity, but we weren't impressed by them just because they could open a door or there wasn't
brush
something
our teeth.
That. Yeah, we tried to let the material speak for itself and really remove our point of view.
He has always been what I call a tough kid. You know, I know very few people that would ever with Martin.
Just to see him out on the court with the tattoos up his arm and the goatee, he's intimidating. He's one of these players that people try to just stay away from.
Well, Mark, help us understand wheelchair rugby, because, as I said, that's the thread that goes through the film, and then it goes off into all of these other directions. But how is the game played? I understand there's a point system, first of all.
Right. You're given a point value depending upon your level of disability or how much function you have. It starts at 0.5, goes to 3.5. You have 8 points on the court at one time. So it keeps it kind of even.
Right. So in other words, if somebody has only a certain amount of use of their hands, let's say, mm-hmm. they get a certain point for that. If somebody has more use of their hands, as you do, you get a different kind of point, and it has to get averaged out.
Right. They test your hands. They test tricep, bicep, just every muscle that you would use to participate.
And describe these Mad Max-like wheelchairs that you're in. I mean, it's just astonishing. You're looking to knock the other guy over.
Of course.
The other guys stop you by slamming their chair into you.
Help him! Dave! Dave! Help him!
You have to dribble the ball or pass to a teammate once every 10 seconds. But other than that, it's basically kill the man with the ball.
The chair is kind of like a mini tank. You look at it and it's reinforced so much more than a regular chair. There's wings. The wheels are cambered out, so they're angled out so it turns quicker. The front end is, it looks like something on a train, a cow catcher.
Right, right.
And you use that to deliver the hits.
Dana, did you know about these sort of quadriplegic gladiators? I mean, when did you hear about it?
I heard about it in the spring of 2002, and I read this article online. It was all about these quadriplegics who play this crazy sport, and I'd thought that all quadriplegics were like Christopher Reeve, that they couldn't move at all, let alone play a full contact Paralympic sport. And in the article, it got into sex and it got into their jobs and driving, and there was comedy in the article. They were sort of ribbing each other. Of course, underneath all of this were these incredible tragedies.
And Mark, in your case, this friend that was driving drunk the night that you got thrown out of the back of his pickup, How did your relationship suffer and then somewhat get repaired after the accident?
I forgave him the instant he came into the hospital. It's not his fault. It was an accident. I mean, you can't be bitter towards somebody who made an accident, a similar accident that you probably would have made.
Because you were drunk in the back
of the
pickup.
Right, I passed out in the back of the pickup truck. Yeah. So our relationship's been up and down since, you know, that day.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, we probably both ended up getting disabled in a way. I did physically, he did maybe mentally. Because you see your best friend, you see him in a chair, and you're like, oh, wait, you know, I did this to him. Hmm. Which has kind of turned into a big joke. It's like, hey, I go, you're the quad father.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious if you ask me.
Well, you know, and I'm wondering too, how...
I mean, it's fun. If you can't laugh at a situation, then you can't live.
First time I saw Mark Zupan was at a friend of ours' funeral. He rolled in, introduced himself, and I don't think we had a moment apart from that night.
So the film explores friendships, relationships, sex. You and your pals, much like many rugby players, talk about sex.
We're just normal people. I mean, everything works fine and dandy, and that's a big misconception. People are like, oh, he's in a chair. He can't do this, or he can't do that.
We didn't want to make sort of an overview of a curious subject. I think a lot of documentaries tend to be overviews. We wanted to make a character-driven story. Not about quadriplegia, but about these particular quadriplegics. And we really wanted to show what it was like to be them, not what it was like to be around them. And the sex part was just, that's what you would see if you went to rehab. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's the elephant in the room. There's very much an undertone of what is masculinity in this film and, you know, this idea that the man is this physical being, this, you know, protector and the sexual thing. And it was taken away from them. They're sitting down now. They're somewhat incapacitated, obviously not even close to completely
watch it.
In all the right places they seem to still be fine.
Well, but, yes, you know, judging by the women who are around them, and in one scene in particular, one woman is asking what I guess women ask you, right, Mark? That, you know, eventually one of the characters says, one of your friends in the film says, in about 20 minutes a woman will somehow find a way to ask, does it work?
Well, of course. I mean, that's human nature. Yeah. It's curiosity.
Mm. Mark Zupan, here you are. You've reached the pinnacle in a sport. You're a superb athlete. Anybody who sees this film is going to be just blown away by it. You're the star of a film. You're passing on what you've learned to other people. You know, people always wonder, how would I feel? What would it be like if this happened to me?
Right.
Is the old life, do you lay awake at night wishing
no.
you could play something? No.
No regrets. You live in the moment. You don't live in the past. And you figure that out. Like, oh, you know, I can't walk. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Because?
Would you and I be sitting here talking today? Yeah. Would I have been afforded the opportunity to go to the Paralympics? No. Would I have been to New Zealand 3 times? Probably not. Would I have met the people and done the things that I have done? No. Hmm. Don't let the chair keep you from doing what you want to do. You can do anything you want.
That's Mark Zupan, one of the stars of the quad rugby documentary Murder Ball. We also spoke with film co-director Dana Adam Shapiro. Murder Ball is now out on DVD. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.